Well, even though everything that's happened, I consider myself a nice person, a caring person.
Okay, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, if there's a just God, maybe I'll go to heaven too. I keep trying.
Donald Harvey might not have been crazy, but he was definitely ODing on self-delusion. You're listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things. Welcome back. I'm your host, Jay Harvey, and this is the third and final part of our Donald Harvey story. And there's a possibility you're beginning this particular podcast with part three. Who knows why? Maybe you're some kind of podcast masochist. Anyway, don't, because that's no fun. So go back and listen to episode one, and then listen to episode two, and then come back here for the end of this whole sordid story of Donald Harvey, the murderous nurse's aide and queer witch. The queer witch thing I'm going to explain this episode finally. We're going to get into Donald's witchery and his communications with ghosts, and also into how he got caught and what his trial or non-trial was like and what eventually happened to him, which wasn't pretty, but let's face it, he had it coming. I'm sorry, that was a mean thing to say, but he really did. I mean, come on. He killed all those old people. Who kills old people? I mean, besides COVID. Before we begin, please note that Wicked Gay is a true crime podcast that contains content such as murder and other unpleasant things. So there may be triggers. Let's get back to Donald. This is Donald Harvey, No Relation, Part 3. So we're going to go back to Donald's time working at Marymount Hospital. This is relevant to our next bit because it touches upon Donald's interest in the occult. Donald had a really odd story to tell the cops when he was caught about his time at Marymount. And it was about his supervisor, who was a registered nurse, he said. An RN who sounds like she shouldn't have been allowed anywhere near a damn hospital, trust me. He claimed that this woman frequently abused drugs and alcohol, coming in unfit to work, and drugging her patients into unconsciousness so she wouldn't have to take care of them during her shift. I mean, I've been that lazy at work before, but I don't have people on life support, depending on me. She'd also reportedly steal her patients' medication and give them placebos instead so she could have their drugs. Another unsavory detail about this lady was that her supposedly insisting that Donald let her know which male patients had the biggest junk so she could make an excuse to see them for herself. So she sounds like a sterling example of humanity. And in Donald's most damning accusation about this lady, he said she caused the death of a six-month-old baby under her care and that it was covered up by the hospital. This, he said, was why he thought he could kill with impunity at Marymount. And I also urge you to remember Vernon from last episode. That was Donald's, one of Donald's first boyfriends, the one who was an undertaker who was allegedly into fooling around with his patients, and I'm putting patients in quotes. Supposedly his supervisor, his trash bag supervisor, was a member of a witch's coven that Vernon was also a member of. And remember I said that Vernon played a big part in Donald's life that didn't involve like dating or like learning about dead people? It was because he introduced Donald to black magic, to this coven. Vernon wouldn't let him take part in the coven's rituals right away, but his young protege was privy to them and did begin his occult education that way. Vernon in that crazy RN's coven, which was based out of Kentucky, was supposedly 60 years old. And did anyone else know that Kentucky, like in the 60s and 70s, was a hotbed for the dark arts? I thought it was all like bluegrass music and that horse race where everyone wears the stupid hats and gets really drunk, all the white people. I couldn't discern what particular version of the occult Vernon practiced, but Donald really got into it and figured into some of his later crimes and his general weirdness. He also claimed that Vernon appropriated organs from the funeral parlor to use in the coven's rituals. If you'll recall, Donald was caught at the VA hospital with a liver in his gym bag, which that's a weird thing to take to the locker room, but and he got fired for that. So that might have been his way of doing the same thing with using organs in his rituals. And this is exactly why you get cremated. I will never not get cremated when I die. Any life, any of my millions of lives on the reincarnation wheel, please, at the end, set my corpse aflame, because otherwise, people desecrate it. There's funeral parlor undertakers who are, I guess, doing horrific things with corpses, and people are stealing organs out of them to use in black magic. Just no. Just slide me down that crematorium slideway and get my cremains, put it in a bowl or an urn and put a flattering photo on top. That's it. Do not leave me whole because bad things happen. Donald wasn't allowed to formally join the coven until June of 1977. It wasn't clear whether or not Vernon and the creepy nurse lady from Marymount were still on the scene. Interestingly enough, though, Donald's initiation was through a ritual that was only meant for heterosexual couples. That must have been why the married Vernon the Undertaker initially kept Donald out of the mix. And I think it's indicative of the negativity and prejudice that the LGBTQ plus community has had to endure for centuries, when even evil occult rituals were heteronormative back then, right? So Donald was hooked up with a woman named Jan as his partner, and apparently they had to have ritual sex. And he later claimed that this resulted in the birth of his second child. And let's pause here for a second, because I realized, and I got a note on this, that last episode I mentioned Donald's two kids. Yes, Donald Harvey had children. He had two. The second one I just told you about was with some Satan lady named Jan, sure Jan. But the first one was after he quit Marymount Hospital. He was looking for work in Frankfort, Kentucky, and he stayed with some family while looking for work. He stayed with his family, and one night, Donald and the family's daughter, Ruth Ann, got super drunk together, and he woke up the next morning naked and no longer a Gold Star gay. And for those of you not in the know, a Gold Star gay is a gay guy who has never been with a woman, and none of your business. So Ruth Ann, unfortunately for her, ended up pregnant from Donald after this, supposedly, and she named the kid who was a son, named him Donald, so Donald Jr. But yeah, Donald had two kids. And fortunately for them, I guess, because he was a serial killer, he wouldn't acknowledge them usually. He would say he didn't have any kids. So they remained kind of out of his life. And think about this, too. Not only was he like a horrible murderer of all these people, but from what I can gather, he didn't pay child support to two of the mothers. I mean, the Satan lady or Ruth Ann. So not only was he a serial killer, but he was also a deadbeat dad, which that's two strikes against you. And how do you explain to people how your parents met? They met when they were both forced to, they both decided to do a satanic ritual to please the devil. So they, you know, banged, even though dad was gay, and they had me. So that's how my parents met. Like that's charming. That's a Hallmark movie. And here's where we get into how Donald's occult practices figured into his crimes. And this is what he revealed to his attorney, William Whalen, his defense attorney, who started off his book about Donald with this story. When it was time for the next murder he was going to commit, most of these murders took place at Daniel Drake Hospital, the third hospital that he killed at before he was caught. So when it was time for his next murder, Donald would go into his bedroom, and he'd turn the lights off, and he'd don a long black robe. And spooky music here, please. He'd stolen a human skull from when he worked at the VA hospital's morgue, and it would serve as the focal point of his evil hocus pocus. It would hold a big black candle that Donald would light. The skull was placed upon a special altar, and four more black candles, smaller ones, were lit around it. So he would have on hand a ledger that he called his Book of Shadows. And wow, that's super cheesy. It was a record book that he contained notes on all the rituals he had practiced, his favorite prayers to, I guess, the devil, and quotes and short poems. I guess Donald might have written poetry about his evil career. It sounds like sort of a vision board, except it was for evil, like an evil vision board, a dream board. Back to the ceremony. Finally, and this is ironic given our current times, Donald would don a surgical mask before he began, and he wore the mask because he didn't want to disturb any of the air in the room with his breath, and you'll see why in a second. So there's no light in the room except for the flickering candles. And speaking of spirits, there was one in particular whom Donald Harvey often sought the advice of. This spirit's name was Duncan, and he served as Donald's spirit guide and victim selector. Donald had supposedly been hooked up with Duncan during his induction into the Black Arts, I guess while he was fucking Jan, and claimed that Duncan was the spirit of a dead doctor. Which, Jesus Christ, did this guy have, like, a boner for making the medical profession look bad or what? And as for why Donald needed a spirit, ghost, or poltergeist or what have you to help him figure out who to kill, well,
I had to have help from somewhere.
He had to have help from somewhere. So, you know, if you're not competent enough to select murder victims yourself, like, maybe you shouldn't be murdering. You have to outsource to the afterlife and be able to assist you in picking people to kill. Come on, Donald. In this particular instance of that ritual that he told his lawyer about, he said he felt that Duncan would be in the room, but he would ask for a sign. According to him, the skull candle would flicker, which took what Donald took to mean that his ghostly guide Duncan was there. I wonder if Duncan was Scottish. Duncan's kind of a Scottish name, right? I keep picturing like a spooky Brian Cox appearing in the room with like a stethoscope. So the first item on the agenda was catching up on old business. So he would tell Duncan about his last victim, saying the person's name. And sometimes Duncan would respond, how it didn't say in the book, but I assume with more spooky candle flickering. Donald confirmed with Duncan the names of his previous victims because he claimed that Duncan was the one who chose them. And I guess he wanted his ghostly mentor to be proud of him, or wanted him to know that he wasn't just yeah-yeah-yeahing his victim choices or whatever. After that, Donald takes out, and I should stop here and mention that the story he told his lawyer about this particular instance was the last one he conducted before he was caught. So it's pretty significant in the Donald Harvey story. So this time, he took out a piece of paper, he said, with four names on it. And they were the names of critically ill patients back at the hospital that he either on his wards or he had access to. He would read these four names aloud to the candles. So he'd read the first name to the first candle that was surrounding the skull. And the candle this time didn't flicker. So he read the second name to the second candle and so on. And on the third name he recited aloud, the candle supposedly flickered. So he read it again and the candle flickered again. And it was the only candle flicker he got. So he knew that Duncan chose that name, the name which was, by the way, John Powell, that was the person that had to die. Imagine that your life, and this is the reason why Donald wore the surgical mask, because he didn't want to disturb the candles, he wanted Duncan to do it. And imagine that your life depends on the air ventilation in this idiot's trailer. Great. And also, John Powell was the murderer that got Donald caught. So Donald must have fallen out of Duncan's favor because Duncan really fucked him over on that one. Donald felt that Duncan was qualified to choose who should die at the hospital because he'd been a doctor in his previous existence. But he also said he wasn't bound by Duncan's supposed choices. As for the other people he killed or attempted to that weren't in a hospital bed, he was just fine with choosing those ones on his own. So none of this is supposed to make any sense. This guy was a serial killer. Logic and good choices have no place here. So now we're in 1987. Donald was working at Cincinnati, Ohio's Daniel Drake Memorial Hospital as a nurse's aide, and he's deep into his murder spree. And at this point, the nurses at Daniel Drake have begun to talk about Donald behind his back, about all the deaths which seemed to follow him around as if he was Jessica fucking Fletcher. So keep in mind he'd already raised concern. Keep in mind that he had already caused concerns. And it was really these heroic nurses at Daniel Drake, frontline workers, by the way, coming to the rescue yet again, who initially got the wheels of justice turning. And along came John Powell, aka Donald Harvey's downfall. Donald killed John, who was 44, by putting cyanide in his gastric feeding tube. Powell had sustained severe brain damage in a motorcycle accident, and he was pretty much a vegetable at that point. So Donald later said that he wondered why they didn't just let John Powell die, and he convinced himself that Powell wanted to die, that he was doing him a favor. Which, probably. I mean, but you really shouldn't be running around like you're the fucking Punisher, right? So he watched Powell twitch and then die after giving him the poison. And then he went through his usual post-murder song and dance. He alerted the nurse on duty, cleaned up after himself, the whole thing. And that was seemingly that. Or so he thought. What Donald didn't know, unfortunately for him, in Ohio, by law, you have to have an autopsy for vehicular accidents. And even more unfortunately for Donald, the autopsy was performed by one Dr. Lee Lehman. Dr. Lehman had a biochemistry background and knew a lot about cyanide, which, as we know, had replaced arsenic as Donald's favorite way to off people. Upon autopsying John Powell, Lehman discovered something. And here's Dr. Lehman himself.
What was unusual was that when we opened the stomach, that I could smell cyanide.
That was Dr. Lehman, who had performed over 100 autopsies by that point in his career, when he came upon Donald's handiwork. Upon autopsying John Powell, Dr. Lehman immediately smelled bitter almonds, which is famously the very distinctive smell of cyanide, and which some people actually can't smell. So Dr. Lehman was in the right profession. The investigation of John Powell's death began. Staff at the hospital were interviewed, and during one of these interviews, Donald Harvey's name was brought up because someone discovered he had a very questionable ending of his last job at the VA hospital. If you recall, they found him with the gun and the piece of liver.
The liver was in his gym bag.
Would he go to the gym, and what happened if it fell out in the locker room? What do you say to somebody when a piece of liver falls out of your gym bag?
I was out of protein bars.
It's bad enough when you're at the gym and like that old guy is like walking around naked and he wants you to see his junk. That's uncomfortable enough, and then body parts are falling out of bags. No. Daniel Drake's employees, they volunteered to take a polygraph test. And Donald did too, because he'd read a book on how to beat them. And he must not have felt very confident in what he read, because he called in sick the day of his scheduled test. When he finally went in and the operator explained how it worked, he suddenly refused to take it. This, of course, looked super shady. So, you know, Donald Harvey, good at murder, not good at evading arrest. Later on, the operator said, given Donald Harvey's psychological makeup, he probably would have passed it, so the joke's on you, Donald. So he looked super shady, and the cops wanted to talk to him one-on-one, and he agreed. And he received the good cop, bad cop treatment until he finally confessed by suddenly saying, I did it, I put cyanide in his G-tube. He said it was because he felt sorry for John Powell and his family. When he was asked by the cops at this point if he was responsible for any more deaths, his response was, and I quote, I don't remember. Sometimes I think I'm two different people, and I don't know what the other one does. Much like his previous confession to multiple murder years before, the cops pretty much ignored this, and the case was closed 2 days after his confession. So, after all those years of creepy mayhem, in April of 1987, Donald Harvey was arrested and indicted for the aggravated first-degree murder of John Powell. This is the point that Harvey's defense attorney William Whalen entered the picture. He initially planned to run a mercy-killing defense, and then, perhaps recalling that Donald told the cops he had an imaginary friend, he was going to try for an insanity defense. So he underwent a competency hearing, and despite all the things I've told you in the past three episodes, he was found sane. So attorney William Whalen's defense strategy changed drastically when someone in the media began suggesting that Donald might have killed more than one person, and then Donald himself confirmed it to him.
The feeling on the part of the police, as it was relayed to me by the reporter, was that they felt this was a one-of-a-kind. It was a mercy killing. He did it, supposedly, he told the police, because he felt sorry for Powell, and Powell reminded him of his father. That was an extra factor in his decision-making.
That was Pat Manarson. He is a former Cincinnati news anchor, and he's the reporter who was the first one to question whether or not Donald Harvey was a multiple murderer. So the Cincinnati news story of the decade sort of just fell into Pat's lap, because shortly after the first story he did on Donald on the air, he received an anonymous phone call from a nurse who claimed to have worked with Donald at Daniel Drake. And she told him that, quote, there is something going on and our supervisors won't do anything about it. She wouldn't give Pat her name because she was looking to keep her job, but she did give him a list of 13 other patients that she suspected Donald had killed. She was prepared, so she did call back with another nurse from Daniel Drake on the line, again, and they told him that they had both gone to their supervisors several times with their suspicions about Donald, but were ignored. And a note to, like, business admins and people in positions of power and corporations, if your decisions make you look like the caricature in a bad movie about evil business people, maybe take a different tact. Maybe do something different, listen, find out if there's been a crazy person on the staff who's been, you know, taking out all the old people. Manarson was one of your go-getter, intrepid reporter types. Don't you just hate those people? And he immediately got the death certificates of all the people on that list, and every one of them read that they had died of natural causes, of course. So he was about to go on the air a couple nights later, and this time five anonymous nurses rang him up. And someone finally used those 1980s party lines for good, huh? Five nurses? Remember those things? Like, you, in the summer, you get on with your friends in different houses and talk. Oh, God, I'm dating myself. Ugh. So Manarson finally convinced the Nurses League of Justice that to meet up with him. So they did, and he found out more about the shady goings-on at Daniel Drake. He found out that the day after Donald's arrest, the chief admin called a staff meeting, and it wasn't one of those ones where, like, someone's droning on, you're falling asleep. At this one, it was about, well, a murder. And he told them that the hospital had done its own internal investigation about Donald and found no indication that he'd killed anybody else. He also said that, the boss also said that the hospital had cooperated with the police investigation, which, to remind you, had closed 2 days after Donald confessed to one murder, and both investigations were now closed. They were also told not to discuss their case amongst themselves and not to talk to the press. Seriously, it's almost goofy how evil these people come off. The nurses later told WCPO that they had filed complaints against Donald, but were told by supervisors to, quote, keep quiet. One nurse even said that she told the police herself, months before Donald's arrest, that she suspected that he was a mercy killer. And Lawrence Whalen, no relation to Donald's attorney, who was the chief of police in Cincinnati at the time, he said there was no record of her approaching them. So someone misfiled something somewhere. I mean, stuff was all
on paper back then, so that is a possibility, I guess. So Pat Manarson realizes he's on to the story of the decade, at least in Cincinnati. Like, he's on to a serial killer. It's a huge deal. Like, you know, trophies and banquets and key to the city type crap. So he approaches Donald's lawyer, William Whalen, with his findings, and Whalen was like, no comment. At first, Whalen thought that Manarson was just out for ratings, and yeah, of course he was, but he was also a reporter and wanted to know the truth. So Whalen takes this in and then decides to go ask his client Donald, hey, did you by any chance kill three hospitals? And he got the shock of a lifetime. So Whalen does meet with Donald in the big house, and he asks him if he was responsible for more than just John Powell's murder. And Donald's like, yes. And Whalen's like, how many more victims? And Donald won't answer at first. And his attorney's like, 5, 10? And Donald's like, more. And the lawyer finally got a ballpark figure when he asked Donald to give a number that he knew the amount of his murders did not exceed. And Donald whispered, 70. Creepy. So Whalen suddenly finds himself in Silence of the Lambs, and he knows that his client is a serial killer now, and he's going to get found out eventually, so he tried like hell to save Donald's life. So he meets up with Donald again, and he tells him that he'd probably be facing the gas chamber, electric chair, hanging, shooting, whatever, like, was going to go down for this, down underground, 6 feet under for this. I mean, 70 murders, which he later added 10 to, by the way. So Donald says to his lawyer, I don't want to die. And William Whalen, the lawyer, keeps it real and says some bullshit about merely granting mercy to these poor souls wasn't going to fly in court, seeing as he had killed so many of them, and he was obviously very into murder. But I was relieving them of their misery, Donald reportedly said to him. To William Whalen's credit, he kept it professional and didn't say, what bitch, or sure, Jan, to that. Donald fesses up and finally admits that, yeah, maybe they weren't all murdered out of the goodness of my heart. And his lawyer tells him that the only way he's going to live through this probably was to, and this is very yucky, use the leverage he had. And that leverage being the people he killed, their identities, and how they were killed and when and all that kind of information, which is really yucky. So Whalen convinced Donald to let him try to negotiate a plea bargain for him, Donald's confessions for his life. And knowing that it might help him avoid the needle, Donald's like, yeah, sure. So later on, when the plea bargain was accepted, because it was, Donald never went to trial. Spoiler. Yeah, he never went to court about these murders. He would supply his lawyer with a handwritten document covering his 18 years of murder and attempted murder. And because I'm a freak and Donald Harvey was like a fastidious homosexual, all I could picture was that he had passed this document over and it was all like scrapbooked with like calligraphy and stickers and stuff like that. My apologies for that last section. I'm kind of the laugh in lieu of crying type, and all this, you know, dark subject matter kind of, I don't know, you have to decompress somehow with joking, I guess. Anyway, moving on. So Whalen goes to Manarson and is like, keep investigating this story. Yes, there is a story, but he won't say anything else. So they have their, you know, as you can imagine, they have a verbal duel, like, I need more information, you can't have it, blah, blah, blah. What the attorney was trying to do was get the story out through someone else to sort of get out in front of it, so the DA would know that they were open to bargaining about it or something like that, instead of it being investigated later on and Donald being caught later on for all the murders. Look, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not, you know, a strategist. So, as you can probably tell, but you know what I'm saying, right? So, on June 23rd, 1987, Pat Manarson's station, WCPO-TV, put on a half-hour special in place of their usual 6 p.m. broadcast. Manarson hosted, and he got into it.
Tonight, a special report on a two-and-a-half-month Channel 9 investigation into the cause of a number of patient deaths at Drake. Our investigation reveals that these deaths occurred in the space of roughly 1 year. They're deaths that outside experts we've consulted believe could have been deliberate killings. The toll may run as high as 23.
And as you can imagine, all hell broke loose after that. There was a new serial killer in Cincinnati, and WCPO had the story. And that's when the DA got involved, and the wheels of justice started to turn, and Donald Harvey's deal that he would confess to all of his murders to survive went through. And it's funny, during these confessions, this is so Donald Harvey, he would use the euphemism "took care of," that's in quotes, instead of the word "murder" when he was talking about his crimes. He used it so much that the detectives who were going over the confessions, they had to verify with him whether or not he was talking about nursing patients or killing them in certain parts of his story. He was such a weirdo. So Donald Harvey's charges and indictments and sentencing is a long list, because he kind of kept adding victims to the list, so they'd indict him again and arrest him again, indict him again, and so on and so on. These are also the confessions in which he said that he might have actually murdered 80 people. So 80 could be an exaggeration, but maybe not, and that's truly frightening. And to sum it up, he ended up serving 28 life sentences, and that was going to be in a row. So that's welcome to your cell, enjoy your life. On the compensation front, 18 civil suits were brought in Hamilton County by the victims' families, which totaled $235 million and involved the hospital administrators and trustees and various medical staff. Donald basically became his own legal industry. And how did Donald's victims' families feel about him avoiding capital punishment? Well, one of them summed it up in this quote: "I think he deserves worse than the death penalty. I think every family member here would like to see him injected with arsenic, rat poison, cleaning fluid, and everything, and die a slow, painful death." And you can't blame them, right? So Donald went to jail, and he would give various interviews during the next couple of years while he was still a hot news item and relevant. And per usual, he was always all over the place and spewing some eye-rolling bullshit, like what you heard him say at the beginning of the episode, like, "I'm such a good guy, I am going to heaven, I really cared about these people," you know, just lies to comfort himself. Donald fancied himself as Hannibal Lecter at one point, so he decided to help out cops and hospitals in avoiding having any more Donald Harveys on their staffs. So here's a few of his suggestions for how to avoid a serial killer as one of your orderlies. One was make nursing rounds random. One was staff should wear quiet shoes and not carry big rings of keys that would announce their presence. And also have more security shakedowns and pat hospital employees down, kind of like the search that got him fired for the VA hospital. I don't know how he didn't get a book contract, right? And he also gave some insight into his thought process when he was giving his patients every substance known to man except for medicine. He said that the helplessness of the individual would incite him to kill them. And for a while there, he also tried to pawn off his murders on a separate identity, like he had multiple personalities like on a soap opera, and that didn't fly. He told one reporter that he felt he was right and he never thought that he had done anything wrong. And in a jailhouse interview with the Cincinnati Inquirer in 1987, he explained how he saw himself telling the reporter that some of those patients might have lasted a few more hours or a few more days, but they were all going to die. "I know you think I played God, and I did." He also claimed that God had forgiven him. God had no comment. So Donald went to jail for a long, long time, and you really only saw him when some news magazine or documentarian was doing a story about angels of death, you know, the medical professionals who killed their patients. But he just kind of grew gray in prison and kept saying that he was a mercy killer or whatever. Yeah, tell that to Diane. And finally, on March 28th, 2017, authorities reported that Donald had been found severely beaten in his cell at Toledo Correctional Institution in Lucas County, Ohio. The angel of death finally faced his own on March 30th, 2017. Donald was murdered, and in kind of an interesting item, the murderer started writing letters to newspapers to explain why he did what he did. It was a fellow inmate, his name was James Elliott, and he later sent letters to the Toledo Blade saying that he punched and stomped Donald in his cell, and that he was not surprised that he died from his injuries, and he actually thought he was dead when he left the cell. Prison is awful. No. No to prison. I will never commit a crime ever in my life. I won't. Won't do it. No prison. James Elliott later was charged with aggravated murder and other charges and was found guilty and received a life sentence. And his motivation was being from the neighborhood of some of the victim's family, so he wanted to avenge them or do them a favor, and also because he wanted to call attention to the bad prison food, which is so pathetic. A reason to die, right? Yeah. Sorry, Donald. So that's the sad, unsettling story of Donald Harvey. And are you ever going to check into a hospital again? You know, I'll heal myself. I'll just heal at home. I'm on the couch. No hospitals for me, because you never know who's nursing. So that was a lot of death nurse negativity we need to wash out of our hair. So let's go on to the wicked good gay of this episode. And that wicked good gay is Bayard Rustin. I didn't know about Bayard Rustin until I was looking for a wicked good gay for this episode, and that's a shame. I probably should have been taught about him in high school, elementary school, that middle school thing, because he's an incredibly important figure in the civil rights movement. And he's especially timely now, at this time in history, when black people are fighting for their equal rights. Bayard worked with Dr. King, and he was part of the March on Washington, and he helped organize freedom rides. And yes, he was there for the famous speech. Unfortunately, because he was gay, and had been arrested for public sex in a car before, which, hi, it's none of your business, the windows are fogged up, you can't see me, he had to kind of hang back and be an activist sort of in the background while others were more in the forefront. And he was a close advisor to Dr. King and really just one of the most influential, I guess, organizers of the civil rights movement. And he was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Honor by Obama in 2013. And that's your Wicked Good Gay for this episode. You can find all the sources I used for Donald Harvey No Relation at the end of episode 1. You Won't Get Away with Murder is our theme song. It's by Gino and the Goons. You can find them on Spotify and Facebook. Additional music by JB, cover art by Paul Chapman, and sound engineering by the other Mr. Harvey. Thanks, guys. Wicked Gay is on the big three social media platforms under Wicked Gay Pod. WickedGayPod@gmail.com is our email address, and the podcast is on all major apps. So please leave a review, which is hugely important if you like this podcast, and subscribe. You've been listening to Wicked Gay, a true crime podcast about gay people doing awful things.